At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 305. We're joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, man?
Hey, just wrapped up some training and a bit of a run and feeling refreshed, ready to go.
Do you feel hybrid?
I suppose I am.
Yeah, you're like sativa and indica mixed. No, sorry. We should have had a warning on the. No, this episode is not about that. But if you lift weights and then you do something that makes you breathe hard from a cardiorespiratory standpoint, I mean, that's hybrid. That's the only way I know how to describe it.
What has been called strength and conditioning for decades.
New term, who dis? Okay, so you are flying blind on this podcast. I have not shared with you the outline that I have spent a considerable amount of time on, and we have a case as well. Before we get into that, there are some headlines, and I just, I didn't want to prompt you with this because I just want your raw take right off the jump, okay? So first off, I don't know if you saw last week, I believe it was last week or might've been the week before, there was a bunch of media attention about these new glucose responsive insulins that they are deeming the holy grail of insulin for individuals with diabetes. So effectively, these insulins respond to the glucose level in the blood and like auto adjust, ideally then making dosing a lot more straightforward for folks. So they're not going to go hypoglycemic from giving themselves too much, or not, they don't get hyperglycemic by not giving themselves enough, particularly for like mealtime insulin or for other reasons why their blood sugar may vary. Have you heard anything about this?
No, I haven't, either previous to this or even I'm not familiar with those headlines. That's pretty interesting. I'd be curious to see how they actually manage that. I mean, the idea of kind of an effective like artificial pancreas has been a holy grail for a long time, and we can get pretty darn close with some somewhat elaborate and advanced technology of like, you know, closed loop systems of insulin pumps and CGMs kind of talking to one another and things like that to continuously monitor your blood glucose levels and then adjust insulin pump activity accordingly, which is definitely a relatively advanced thing that's not done, you know, super commonly for run-of-the-mill, you know, patients with diabetes. But if there is somehow an insulin product that is somehow responsive to your plasma glucose levels, I'm actually quite curious how they manage that. That's an interesting thing. It's kind of like an internal or standalone artificial pancreas product, which sounds in some ways too good to be true, but we'll see.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different research groups working on this. One's at Stanford, one's in Australia, one's in China. And actually, there's a recent article from a research group in China showing some efficacy of this in animal models. So I don't know how long it's going to take for that to potentially come to fruition for like a human model, but certainly caught my attention because I was like, first, you say holy grail. I want to know of what, like hook it up. Sure. And then you say of insulin, I'm like, well, now first you had my curiosity. Now you have my attention. So,
yeah, I mean, as somebody who manages diabetes every single day, multiple times a day in a lot of patients, and having been doing this for, you know, a little while now and knowing a bit more about the history, I mean, our tools in the past were just extremely crude to try to get good, you know, control of people's blood sugar levels. And in the past, you know, we had these really kind of clunky instruments, would be the best way that I have to describe them in terms of, you know, insulins, in terms of their duration of action and their efficacy and various other kind of non-insulin options that worked okay to like help you die a little bit less, but still didn't do a great job of getting the level of control we want to really improve the other detailed outcomes like people's risk of cardiovascular disease, neurologic disease, kidney disease, and various other things. And so the more advanced all of these products get, the more control we can have, not just in, you know, broad terms like, oh, I can say that your blood sugar has been like okay over 3 months, to the point where I might be able to say like, okay, I can say that your blood sugar is well controlled minute to minute throughout the day. That would be the goal because that's what our pancreas does for us, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The other headline, and I think you might have seen this. This is from a friend of the show, Dr. Eric Helms. He had shared this, that there's like a research trial that just got registered about acute markers that correlate to hypertrophy response. The idea is like it's going to be a, you know, pan scan of all of the literature that currently exists on muscular hypertrophy to see, are there any things in the short term that could actually predict a hypertrophy response? Now, I know the people listening to the show, they're like, oh, that'd be so awesome if there was like a way to measure, particularly non-invasive, because I think that's the actual point of this research, to see if there's anything non-invasive. Basically, you could do maybe a smartphone or like a wearable tech or something like that. And it would like say, oh, yeah, hey, you reached the threshold for growing some muscle. So cool. I'm not concerned with that for like the recreational lifter. I think, sure, that would be a, you know, kind of good commercial use, or at least a viable commercial product. But the bigger thing would be for like health, particularly in aging populations or vulnerable populations to sarcopenia, because it's like, yes, we know that exercise is, you know, going to be health promoting. How much of it? Question mark. How to do it? Question mark. We have some, you know, first principles kind of things. But as far as something that's showing efficacy, one of our biggest concerns with, you know, promoting exercise is like not only an intervention for sarcopenia, but a way to reduce the risk of sarcopenia is like, well, what's the dose? You know, at like how much is enough? And like we the problem is we can't tell until after the fact, right? Like, yeah, we'll give you this 12-week intervention and we'll, you know, cross our fingers that we're crossing our T's and dotting our I's. But, it would be nice that if some point in the middle, you're like, actually, you're not meeting these threshold, you know, variables that have decently, that are decently correlated to, you know, sort of outcomes. So the question to you, Austin, would be, how tightly correlated would one or more of these variables need to be for it to change what you do as far as either recommendations go on like a broad scale, or maybe even more applicable to like an individual? Like how, what sort of like R value, correlation value would you need to be like, yeah, this is interesting enough for me to use, and so I will use it?
Oh, that's an interesting way of framing the question. I mean, my initial response to your discussion there was, I would not be as inclined to care about or differentiate or dichotomize between recreational athletes and like health related populations. But rather, if we had a tool that had, I would say, at least moderate predictive value, maybe I'll hand wave it and put it in that range, then what I would kind of, the way I would view it is effectively a tool to help, suss out inter-individual variation regardless of the context. So it could be, you know, we know that you give the same program to a bunch of different people. Say you have 100 people in a room, you have 30 athletes, you have 30 regular Joes, and you have 30, you know, sick, you know, multi-morbid patients, and they're all going to respond differently to some extent. And so, as you said, at this point in time, we have to just do it and then see what happens to them. And as we've talked about before, hypertrophy responses, if that's the outcome you're looking for, muscle growth, it just takes too long for you to be able to rapidly kind of iterate or rapidly change your program to find something that works. Like, you just can't tell fast enough. And so that would be what appeals to me about this idea, if it does in fact pan out, which again, I remain skeptical that it will, but should it, and at least give us moderate or stronger kind of predictability, that would at least be a tool that you could use to guide your decision-making on a shorter timescale. Meaning I don't need to run a program for, you know, 3 months or something before I can feel confident that like, oh, growth has really happened here versus not. You might be able to, take your two different populations, say this, you know, this patient, this person, this athlete, and do this program. And, you know, again, there's going to be some uncertainty and some imprecision and some, you know, false positives and false negatives, as there are with all testing. But if you do, if you run a particular training program or protocol, if you want to call it that, and your, you know, non-invasive biomarker that you use that supposedly has good predictive value is showing you, man, nothing's really happening here, then I would probably pivot away from that plan sooner than I would on a regular run-of-the-mill program where I'd say, it's just too soon to tell. We got to run this out and see what happens. And that would be really useful. I would say I agree with you that it would be more useful in a sick population where you have kind of more pressure. You want to get this going in the right direction sooner, right? So like say somebody who is, you know, thin, frail, and suffers a hip fracture and they get their hip replaced or fixed and you get them walking, you know, post-op day zero and you get them moving, but you definitely want to get some lean body mass on them. I would rather not wait 3 months to know if my program was adequately dosed. And so that's just one extreme of the inter-individual variation. But of course, athletes and bodybuilders and people who really want to quote unquote optimize are going to geek out on this too. And to the extent it helps them narrow down what they as an individual responds to better or worse on a shorter time scale compared with that much longer period to really noticeably identify hypertrophy, absent fat gain and stuff like that, then that could be a potential useful tool. So that's my answer. And yeah, hand waving around like moderate predictive value because we don't have anything else better. And so I'm okay with that, right? I just remain skeptical that it's going to actually work, but we'll see.
Yeah, no, that's honestly, you led me into my take on it. I was like, honestly, I'd be willing to accept almost any reliable correlation. Like if the data set is sufficiently large to kind of make you feel confident that even if there's like a small correlation between this non-invasive metric and outcomes, I'd be like, hey, well, we don't have anything right now, really, you know, and if I had was changing programming or considering it anyway, well, this is just one more, you know, sort of mark in the pros column as far as changing. You're like, well, we haven't been meeting this sort of threshold criteria for a few weeks, so I'm going to hedge my bets and change it. So we do.
That's fair. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get into the case file for this, the case report for this particular podcast, again, episode 305 with Dr. Austin Baraki. Now, you know, I can't share with you the podcast, can't share with you the case, because otherwise, then what are we doing? I'm just reading to you and you're reading back to me. It's just not a thing. But I think that this may be the biggest challenge yet for you.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yeah, because you really just have to kind of be in the right mindset, taking in all the clues. And then I think, feel like you're just going to have to get a little lucky on this. But you know what? You have surprised me every single time so far. So... Let's find out. This is a 28-year-old male who was found down, unresponsive, in his home by his mom and brought to the emergency department via EMS. In the emergency department, he was sweating profusely, had severe difficulties breathing, requiring the use of accessory respiratory muscles. He was febrile, so he had a fever to 101.4 and a prominent jugular venous distension. He was subsequently intubated and put on pressors for blood pressure and circulatory support. So history was obtained from his mom, where she said the patient had no past medical history and is otherwise very healthy. He's never had an episode like this before. He is a, quote, bodybuilder who works out regularly, taking many over-the-counter supplements. She does not know if he uses steroids, but relates he has a summer trip that he has been preparing for. She says he has no allergies, has had no sick contacts that she knows of, and doesn't take any medications. So before anything else, do you have any thoughts?
Wow. So this is a pretty dramatic presentation. Somebody who's found down is a ominous sort of thing, right? So you immediately get worried about, did this patient have some kind of a cardiovascular catastrophe or some kind of a neurologic catastrophe are the first two things that you want to be thinking about, right? So the initial kind of evaluation and the things that emergency medical services would do in the field, effectively what happens during a quote unquote code blue type scenario, right? You start doing CPR and you make sure that you're getting some oxygen into the patient and you think about what are all the upfront most kind of immediate causes of somebody effectively having a cardiac arrest or being found down in this way. And so that addresses the cardiac aspect of things. And then, as I said, you can also have some kind of a neurologic catastrophe, a bleed, a seizure, or something like that in the neurological system would be the first two places that I'd be thinking. Now, when we get some initial description of this patient, he's sweating, has some shortness of breath. Presumably, you know, obviously at this point, he has been resuscitated to some extent, that he has a pulse and has a blood pressure, because I didn't get any other vital signs there. He has a fever. And jugular venous distension means the big veins in your neck are kind of prominent, like what you see when either of us deadlift, they get prominent. And that can be a sign of either an increase in pressure in the right side of the heart or in the thoracic cavity, or an increase in blood volume that is kind of leading to congestion and backup. So then, of course, because he was found down and having these issues, it sounds like they put breathing tube down his throat and got him on the ventilator, which is useful to keep him stabilized from that standpoint. And when you said pressors, those are medicines that are used to artificially increase people's blood pressure when they're too low due to shock, which can happen if you don't have enough blood volume or if you have some obstruction to flow into or out of your heart. or if you have some reason why your blood vessels are not maintaining their tone. We call that distributive shock, like from sepsis or something like that. So then the last part is this bodybuilder taking a bunch of supplements. And so in the context of you know, this presentation, I'm concerned about a few different things. As I mentioned, cardiovascular or neurologic catastrophe due to or independent of the supplements and the things like that that he was taking, some sort of a behavioral aspect. And so my initial, you know, approach here, aside from getting some initial vital signs, examining him, probably putting like an ultrasound probe on his heart and lungs and seeing what's going on in there, would be working through that emergency checklist of things that can lead people to just collapse in that way and get some initial laboratory studies. I am concerned if he's sweating and has a fever and things like that about either, you know, when we see patients with fevers that reflects inflammation, that can be due to an infection, which I'm not as concerned about here, possible, but a little bit less concerned. You can have it from cancers and autoimmune conditions, which don't tend to present this suddenly and this dramatically most of the time. And then certain drugs can do it. And then if you have certain endocrine or hormone related issues, that can also lead to fevers and this kind of stimulated kind of state. So I'm concerned mostly about like he's overly stimulated from like a sympathetic or an adrenergic standpoint, leading to fever and sweating and difficulty breathing and things like that. The only thing that doesn't fit that is if his blood pressure is so low that he needs blood pressure support, because usually those patients have high blood pressures. And that's where I'm invoking this prominent jugular vein, indicative of maybe the issue with his blood pressure is due to something going on around his heart. For example, does he have a giant blood clot in his lungs or a pulmonary embolism? That could do that. Does he have a pericardial effusion? That's another thing, fluid accumulated around his heart. That could lead to impairment in blood flow and low blood pressure and shock states and things like that. So that there's just so many possibilities here that you would do a rapid assessment. And within the first 10, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, a lot of these things would be answered in person. But yeah, cardiovascular, neurologic, and then interrogating the possibility of some kind of sympathetic adrenergic intoxication, withdrawal, and trying to get a list of those supplements if I could would be my upfront tasks.
All right. Well, I can give you some of the information that you request, but not all of it. Okay. So the patient was admitted to the ICU. He was unable to participate in the exam or history taking. He is sedated on a ventilator and on pressors, again, as you mentioned, for blood pressure. No vital signs are available for this particular patient. I assume that the machine that they use to measure blood pressure and respiratory rate and everything just completely broken or otherwise unavailable.
Wow. Okay.
Not reported at all, so you don't get it either. His initial labs in the emergency department were significant for a white count to 40,000 in this case, a potassium level of 6, a creatinine level slightly elevated to 1.5, his lactic acid was 0.8, troponin was 14.5. He had mildly elevated liver enzymes and a negative drug screen. His EKG showed ST wave elevations in the infralateral leads. He also had an emergent coronary angiography that was performed, and it showed patent coronary vessels. So the blood vessels in his heart were open and doing their normal thing, but poor movement of the heart, which sometimes we call global hypokinesis. He had an echocardiogram subsequently done on the spot, and his ejection fraction was measured at 10%.
Oh, my.
Yeah, he also had an intra-aortic balloon that was placed for circulatory support during the angiography. So
wow.
At this point, Austin, any further revision of your differential diagnosis? And again, for the listeners at home, Dr. Baraki did an excellent job at providing an extensive differential diagnosis. And the key here is that you must have the correct diagnosis in your initial list, no matter how long or short it is. That is the key to success.
Okay. So yeah, you gave me a lot of data there. And so in summary, now I'm going to update kind of my summary of this case. We have a 28-year-old male found down, brought in, and now found to be effectively in cardiogenic shock. That is what I would call this state that he has. His heart is squeezing at 10% when we would like it to be more like 50 or 60%. And he's requiring blood pressure raising medicines, which is probably sounds a bit foreign to most folks out there who are used to people taking both medicine to lower their blood pressure. We're like actively trying to make it go higher here. So a young male in cardiogenic shock who has this, you know, background history as a bodybuilder, taking some supplements and things like that. The lab presentation, it is generally not super helpful to narrow me further into a particular diagnosis. Like the white blood cell count of 40, you can see that in patients who are in profound states of stress or infections or inflammation or shock, etc. The potassium and the creatinine, again, not terribly, you know, directive in a particular direction here. The fact that his lactate is 0.8 means that they did a phenomenal job resuscitating him, and his vasopressors, despite not having a blood pressure on hand, I can feel confident that His blood pressure is currently adequate because usually if you're in shock and not at don't without adequate blood pressure, your lactate will go up. The troponin I already know is abnormal in the context of him being in cardiogenic shock. And the rest, again, was more helpful to rule something, make some things less probable than more. And so now we're effectively trying to solve this case of, again, of cardiogenic shock. And the main kind of causes that we would think about are massive ischemic events, like a massive type of a heart attack. But this can also happen from infections that can lead people to develop basically severe myocarditis and lose their heart squeeze. Autoimmune conditions that can cause inflammatory myocarditis, same thing, can lose your heart squeeze. There can be congenital cardiomyopathies that can present in 28-year-olds that can, you know, they can compensate and do okay for a long time until they finally decompensate and they present with heart failure. Although this is still a bit dramatic for something like that. And then toxic factors that I would think about in terms of an ingestion. For example, I've seen patients who had massive cocaine use, for example, leading to, this very presentation, although the patient that I saw, he was a couple decades older and was getting ready for a concert. And then effectively the same kind of presentation happened where he came in cardiogenic shock, found down, et cetera. And then, as I mentioned initially with the fever breakdown, I said infections and cancers and autoimmune conditions, drugs, and then endocrine related issues. Hormone related things like issues with the thyroid or certain other related issues. So again, I'm still wanting to I'm reassured that he didn't have a massive heart attack. I'm still mostly concerned about either some sort of a toxic issue here, in which case I really want his medication supplement list and could potentially be talking to a toxicologist or poison control for some additional input here. And then also the endocrine related issues. So definitely want to assess his thyroid situation among other endocrine related factors that can precipitate something like this. That would be the next place that I would go, because aside from his heart being overwhelmingly trashed, the rest of his organs are actually not that bad right now.
All right. Well, again, ask and you shall receive, at least some parts of what you want. So he had a negative respiratory viral panel. His blood cultures were negative, also negative for HIV. TSH came back at 0.008, which is low. His free T4 also came back low, 0.26, which is normal range is 1 to 2.5. And his free T3 was 12.6. Normal is 2 to 4. All right. Any thoughts, potentially a diagnosis here? Also, nephrology, endocrinology, and toxicology were all consulted. And, at this point, they came up with a working diagnosis. So you're tasked with, basically being the umbrella physician here for three separate specialties.
Yeah. I mean, some of those things are useful. So you mentioned the respiratory viral panel being negative. That's actually as I said, viral infections can lead to myocarditis and put young people into cardiogenic shock. This is not just a COVID phenomenon. This has been going on for decades. The flu can actually cause something like this, for example. So there was a bit of an infectious evaluation, as I mentioned. So my main concerns, my broad categories that I had been entertaining after he had the heart cath and it showed that he didn't have a heart attack, the remaining ones that I was worried about was something infectious, something toxic, and then something hormone related. And so the only signal that we have right now after ruling out heart attack and infections, or at least the ones that they tested for, is this kind of very abnormal hormone panel relating to these thyroid blood tests. So his TSH is very, very suppressed. And so after our last episode, we talked about how, there's this feedback system in place that when your thyroid hormone levels go up, your TSH levels will go down most commonly. And so sure enough, when we look at T4, the more kind of common hormone that we look at, that's actually also low. So that's not the cause of the kind of feedback suppression of his TSH. But his T3 is actually very elevated. And interpretation of T3 testing can be a little bit more complex and is not always done in all cases. But this is seemingly a case of T3 toxicosis would be how I would kind of, that would be my working diagnosis right now. So patient cardiogenic shock with T3 thyrotoxicosis. And then the question, as we have discussed before, is where is this T3 coming from? And so I am most concerned that in preparation for his trip or his bodybuilding show or whatever, he has some supplement or that is contaminated with T3, also known as leothyronine, is the kind of pharmacologic version of it, or Cytomel, or he is just outright taking T3 in order to aggressively ramp up his metabolism and get shredded and then lose all this weight, but happens to have put himself into thyroid storm, cardiogenic shock effectively as a result of that. So that is where I'm at kind of right now, I think.
All right. So nephrology, endocrinology, toxicology were all consulted, and they recommended supportive treatment for this patient. He was stable while intubated and sedated, so traditional heart failure therapy was not initiated. Usually when you go into the hospital and you have signs of heart failure, whatever, you get a laundry list of not only interventions but also medications, just kind of like standard protocol. But they said, hey, he's stable. Let's just wait and see. His T3 level decreased rapidly, which coincided with the patient's improvement. He had a repeat echocardiogram on hospital day 2, showed his ejection fraction had bumped up from 10% to now 35%. He was extubated, so they pulled the tube out that was helping him breathe on hospital day 3, and pressors were also stopped. On hospital day 6, his ejection fraction was up to 61%. And at this time, the patient admitted to taking clenbuterol, T3, testosterone, and trenbolone weekly for the last 6 months. And so the diagnosis that they got to was acute heart failure secondary to thyrotoxicosis due to exogenous T3 supplementation.
Hell yeah. 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 I mean, that was my initial thought was like, gosh, how would I manage this if I were in charge of this case? Because usually when you have symptomatic, you know, thyrotoxicosis or something like that, you might, for example, put somebody on a beta blocker, just as like what I do that all the time for patients with like symptomatic hyperthyroidism. That would be a terrible idea in this patient because he came in cardiogenic shock. So there's a lot of the medicines that you would normally use for this that you wouldn't use. However, the caveat is that his thyroid issue was just due to the fact that he's taking this supplement. And fortunately, the best news for him, despite the terrible decision-making that led to this, is that T3 that he was taking is very, very, very short-acting. As opposed to T4 or levothyroxine, which is much more often used for thyroid replacement, T3 is super short-acting, which that's why as soon as they stopped it, because he was sedated on a ventilator, it rapidly cleared from his system. And that is an amazing increase in his ejection fraction over the course of 48 hours. We rarely see it improve that quite that quickly, but that just reflects, you know, the state that he was in and the super short half-life of T3 compared with T4.
Yeah. Yeah. They actually make a comment on, you know, the use of the pressors in this particular case. They actually thought that the clenbuterol supplementation, which is a beta receptor agonist. So you can think about that as the opposite of a beta blocker. Mm-hmm. Bodybuilders tend to use this for fat loss, but it's not approved for use in the United States. It may have exacerbated the patient's situation, leading to this unnecessary treatment with pressors. And the authors comment that, like, you know, we could have used a short-acting beta blocker like Esmolol instead, just to see, like, are we have some, oof, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a scary prospect to potentially cause another code blue in this kid.
There were no vital signs reported the entire case, but I imagine that the guy turned up, you know, blood pressure crashing, you know, all sorts of stuff. And you're like, well, we got to start pressors on this guy rather than, you know, no one saying, hey, maybe try like a beta blockade just real quick to see like some. Yeah, that'd be tough to do, I think.
Yeah. And I think that's just reflective of like the modern medical system is phenomenally good at like hyper acute emergencies like this, at stabilizing this kind of scenario, where the fact that nobody thought to do that is actually probably for the best, but not a huge deal ultimately for him. But interesting case, and it all makes sense.
Yeah, so like a thyrotoxicosis-induced heart failure. So just kind of a little review of the physiology here. The thyroid gland normally makes mostly T4. That's inactive, with a bit of T3, which is the active version of the thyroid hormone, in the periphery, so out into the bloodstream. T4 is converted to either T3 or another inactive form. Now, in thyrotoxicosis, you got a buttload of T3 hormone floating around. T3 binds to the thyroid hormone receptor on heart muscle cells and other cells as well, but specifically when we're talking about heart failure. So this affects the ion channels, and specifically the beta adrenergic receptors that respond like to fight or flight related stimuli. When we say adrenergic, we just mean like adrenaline responding type receptors. That's where that comes from, that lead to the heart beating harder and faster. T3 also has direct effects on the vascular system as well, generally causing a decrease in resistance, making them dilate. The kidneys see this as reduced blood flow and then try to increase total blood volume. So basically retain a lot more water and fluid to try to make up for the low flow. So in the short term, everything's gravy with this, but if it's sustained, it can cause heart failure, cardiomyopathy, or other heart cardiac conditions, more commonly with thyrotoxicosis or hyperthyroidism, which we're going to discuss today. It's like atrial fibrillation. You get some congestive heart failure as well. But the biggest pearl, the biggest takeaway here is do-it-yourself polypharmacy, to me, is absolutely insane. That's a little crazy, but that's balanced out by the fact that it's really hard to kill 20-somethings.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he had very little other medical conditions that were complicating his course. All we had to do was support him and not give him any more T3, and he was going to get better. But cardiogenic shock is a high mortality condition for most other people, but this one, he got away with it.
Yeah, there you go. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. Now, I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert. So you can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. I wanted to take a second to talk about our new podcast sponsor, Mint Mobile. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again, because when they say $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, they mean it. There's no surprise monthly bills and unexpected overages. They have premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month, and all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/BBM. That's mintmobile.com/BBM. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/BBM. $45 upfront payment required, that's equivalent to $15 a month, and this is limited to new customers on a first 3 month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigabytes on the unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply. See Mint Mobile for details. All right. So this particular podcast, episode 305, is going to be talking about hyperthyroidism. But before we do, a few announcements. One, again, over on our website, we have a number of free calculators and tools that you can use, everything from calculating your daily energy intake, calories, macronutrients, zones for conditioning, 1RM calculator. It's all free. Go over to the website, click the About tab. Then click resources. You can go there. Also, the Android app has been on the Google Play Store for quite a long time. So if you're interested in that, if you're a Greenbubble person, you can check that out in the Google Play Store. We have a template quiz that we created, so you can kind of crawl inside my brain and figure out what template I would recommend for you if you're on the fence about a new template or a starting your first barbell medicine template. Speaking of new templates, our push-pull leg templates are available at a lower price point. And we got some questions on this. People are like, well, why are these at such far reduced prices? Like, why did you do that? The idea is that if you're new to barbell medicine, perhaps you come in through some of our more gen pop type of content. You know, maybe you don't need the explanatory power behind, like, why do we program things a certain way, or what is our sort of general, you know, overview on nutrition, science, dietary patterns, food behavior. You don't need all of that. You just want the template. And so there you go. If it gets you into the barbell medicine sort of ecosystem and you like our stuff, great. But we have two different versions of that. We have a hypertrophy focused one and a power building focused one. And, you know, push-pull legs is not my preferred split personally, but a lot of people do like that sort of training split. So we can support you on your training journey there. All right. We're back here on episode 305 with Dr. Austin Baraki. We're talking about hyperthyroidism. Our last episode was on hypothyroidism, hypo meaning low, hyper meaning too much. So let's start out with some anatomy and physiology. Now, the thyroid gland sits midline in front of the neck, really in front of the voice box or the larynx, around C5 to T1, those two vertebrae. physiologically, we're talking about another endocrine organ, all right, which means it produces hormones that function at distant sites throughout the body. So it starts with the hypothalamus. This is a small structure deep in your brain, and this produces thyroid-releasing hormone. That travels down to the pituitary gland, and the pituitary gland then produces thyroid-stimulating hormone, also known as TSH. And then TSH travels to the thyroid gland itself, stimulates the thyroid gland to do its thing and produce thyroid hormones. Again, it's predominantly T4, like 90% of the thyroid hormone that is created is T4, and this is inactive, and a much smaller amount of T3, which is the active thyroid hormone. So we're talking about hyperthyroidism, and this is a form of thyroid hormone toxicity or thyrotoxicosis due to inappropriately high thyroid hormone levels for one reason or another. So diagnosis here requires suggestive lab evidence, as hyperthyroid symptoms are nonspecific and may be present in patients with either subclinical disease and absent in those with other signs of overt disease, especially older adults. There's a kind of two separate categories here that all get lumped together when we talk about hyperthyroidism. One is called overt, which is also known as clinical hyperthyroidism. And this refers to patients with an elevated levels of T4, T3, or both, and a subnormal or low level of TSH. This is typically with suggestive symptoms. And there's also subclinical hyperthyroidism. And this means you have some abnormal labs that look suggestive of hyperthyroidism, predominantly a low TSH level, except normal thyroid hormone levels. So normal T3 and T4 usually, and typically no symptoms. Although depending on which guidelines you read and kind of which overview summary, there'll be some controversy over, well, look, subclinical and overt, you know, whatever, they can present the same way. The laboratory evidence isn't really, too compelling as far as like the degree of symptoms that you see. However, that's just kind of the two major buckets that they sort of fall into. Now, Austin, when you're in the hospital, again, we talked about this last time, you don't normally think about the thyroid gland directly most of the time, except, you know, when I, you know, try to pimp you on one of these case files, you know that the gland's there. In general, people aren't showing up for some sort of thyroid disease unless it's severely low, right? And or severely high. So since we're talking about severely high thyroid levels, what sort of stuff do people present with when their thyroid is running amok?
Yeah, I would say that I actually, to the extent that I'm going to see you or deal with you in the hospital setting for something related to your thyroid, it's actually more commonly going to be an overactive thyroid issue than it is an under. Although, like I said, in both situations, it's going to be when you're at the extremes that I'm going to meet you. Otherwise, that's more of an outpatient type of issue. But in general, overactive thyroid function, just think about everything getting turned up and sped up. So people can be kind of anxious, irritable. They can be tremulous or having a bit of a shaking tremor, a racing heart or heart palpitations. They might be generally warm. They might actually have an overt fever. It can be sweaty. They might have unintentional weight loss. And many organ systems can be impacted in one way or another by excess thyroid hormone, just because, again, it just ramps up cellular metabolism and activity all over the case. So I would say that those are the most common ones that I might see. If I'm going to be admitting you for overactive thyroid, it's probably going to be related to something cardiovascular. Like you came in and your heart rate won't get below 140, no matter what the ER tries to do to you. And so then we're like, oh, just, you know, we check a TSH and then we have to start doing some, you know, interventions or medicines to get the whole system calmed back down.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. I mean, most patients with overt or clinical hyperthyroidism have a number of symptoms traditionally related to this adrenergic stimulation, which the word comes from adrenaline sort of stimulation. So adrenaline related stimulation. So if you think about your fight or flight response, like all the things that happen there, imagine that being turned up to 11. And that's generally the case with hyperthyroidism. So you described some of the traditional symptoms, particularly ones that would get you in the hospital. Some other more interesting things, at least in my estimation, because they're not as discussed quite as frequently, probably due to the how often they don't show up. But one of the things that happens is both gynecomastia and erectile dysfunction in men. So what happens when your thyroid levels are super high, if you're a guy, you can start producing more steroid hormone binding globulin, which does tend to increase total testosterone. But because that binds to the testosterone in the bloodstream, you're actually free. Testosterone goes down a little bit. And also you get a higher degree of aromatization, so conversion of testosterone to estrogen in the periphery. And so that higher estrogen level can lead to gynecomastia, so increase in size of the breast tissue in men, and the libido can actually go down as well, potentially leading to erectile dysfunction. There's also some direct effect on sperm production, which can be another reason why somebody might get diagnosed with erectile dysfunction. Some other signs that people might get: menstrual abnormalities, hyperdefecation, which is exactly what it sounds like. Also, excellent word. And it should be distinguished from diarrhea, which is generally loose stools, whereas hyperdefecation is just an increase in frequency of solid stools. So just a little something to impress your friends at the bar with later on if you decide to talk about poo. I don't know what your friends talk about, but that's something that regularly comes up in conversation here at Barbell Medicine. Other things that may present here include goiter. This is plus or minus. It can be nodular. We'll talk about sort of nodular causes for hyperthyroidism. Also thyroiditis. So the actual gland itself is sort of inflamed and enlarged. And so sometimes people have, a goiter, a bigger sort of neck. Other signs you might see: changes in lipids, blood cell morphology, other non-thyroid labs can be changed as well. And again, as we talked about in not only this case, but last week's case, there can be severe sort of instances of thyrotoxicosis. One of the ones that you described last week, kind of not in passing because it was like a different form of the same thing that the person had, was this thyrotoxic periodic paralysis. Do you see that in the hospital? Do people show up for that?
I won't say it's super common, but I will say that I've diagnosed probably a handful of cases over the past decade or so. And this just is a result of having some abnormalities in an ion channel. And so in the they usually have associated thyroid hormone abnormalities. And in the context of exercise, high carbohydrate meals, a few other things, these patients can develop basically acutely, rapid decreases in their potassium levels, and it can just make you profoundly weak. I think there's also an association. It tends to be more often in males, and I also think there's an association with folks from Asia, maybe the Philippines. It's like that's like the somewhere in the back of my brain that association's there, and so that's something I've seen a handful of times over the years. So it's definitely real.
Yeah. As far as who it affects, the overall prevalence of hyperthyroidism is approximately 1.3%. It increases to about 4 to 5% in older women. And it is more common in women in a sort of 5-to-1 ratio, although there is a higher prevalence of that thyrotoxic periodic paralysis in men. There's some thought that there might be some involvement of testosterone in that particular receptor and channel. In any case, it's also most common in iodine replete areas, so places that have enough iodine in their diet, as iodine deficiency may actually mask presentation. And if you look at areas that have low iodine intake, that where hypothyroidism is certainly more common, their rates of hyperthyroidism are far lower than anywhere else in the world. And so, if you just looked at that, you'd say, oh, look, I just need to do what those people are doing to not have a risk of hyperthyroidism. But the reality is it's mostly because they're actually iodine deficient. And if they moved to an area that had sufficient iodine, they would likely present with hyperthyroidism. It's also more common in smokers. Now, there are a lot of conditions that are more common in smokers. This one seems to be related to the autoimmune kind of version of hyperthyroidism, which is called Graves' disease. But yeah, smoking in general, not good for health. Again, big surprise, Barbell Medicine, we are not pro smoking. So yeah, you guys can take that to the bank. As far as the pathophysiology, so like what's going on here, in general, the way I look at it is three separate categories here. You're either making too much hormone, taking too much hormone, like in our particular case here, or there's some reason that you have more thyroid hormone being made elsewhere, right? So it could be some sort of autonomously functioning tissue somewhere else. Graves' disease is the most common form of hyperthyroidism overall, especially in younger. Now, this is an autoimmune disease where it stimulates the thyroid stimulating hormone, the TSH receptors. And so effectively, you get a ton more T4 and T3 production by the thyroid. One of the more interesting and more common signs that people get with this is this eye condition, right? And it does kind of, if you've seen Austin do a deadlift, particularly if it's close up on his face, you'll notice his eyes will tend to bug out, this sort of exophthalmos or proptosis. So the eyelids appear retracted. The folks have infrequent blinking due to swelling of the clear membrane over the whites of the eyes. And it's usually bilateral. The eyes just stick out more than normal. Do you know what this is called, how it's measured, Baraki?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen diagrams of this where they have like a patient pictured in profile, and then they have like a degree in millimeters of kind of protrusion of the eye compared with like the plane of the forehead.
Yeah, it's an exophthalmometer. And there was an old person's name in front of that I cannot pronounce. The 99th percentile for white men is 21 millimeters. So then what I took from that was like, I wonder if anybody's measured proptosis during exercise. And if so, like, how would they do that? I was very curious. I did not find any normal values or any way anybody had measured that. However, it did lead me down a rabbit hole of like dynamic proptosis. So basically you can get your eyes to protrude forward voluntarily. So for example, you do a Valsalva maneuver, the eyes will kind of protrude a little bit more also if you bend over. And so then I started looking at your Instagram feed, Austin. Now, okay. I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but your eyes look significantly different when you're deadlifting versus when you're squatting.
Interesting.
Which I attribute to the positional change being a little bit more dramatic. There's also some conditions that can cause this pulsatile proptosis, where particularly if there's like some venous congestion behind the eyeball.
Yeah, you can see that also with like carotid cavernous fistulas, which is a very dangerous condition to have.
Yeah. And then there's this the second more common thing that's discussed with Graves is called pretibial myxedema. So this is it's also called a thyroid dermopathy, which is a skin condition where the skin is actually thickened, and it tends to happen in this sort of pretibial area, so the skin in front of your shin bone, because it's a gravity-dependent area. There's also thought to be some mechanical factors at play there, and it's effectively an autoimmune stimulation of fibroblasts. Those are little cells in the area that produce an increase in connective tissue protein just under the skin. Interestingly, this can actually happen anywhere. So there's been this thought to maybe call it like localized myxedema versus just pretibial myxedema or localized thyroid dermopathy of the pretibial region. But I don't know. Do you see that in the hospital? Have you ever come across that?
This particular skin condition is not something that I would be confident diagnosing in an inpatient, because there are just so many reasons for people's leg skin to be looking jacked up when you're a hospitalized inpatient.
Yeah, fair enough. So that is the most common cause of hyperthyroidism, but it's not the only cause. There's another condition that's referred to as hashitoxicosis. This is autoimmune destruction of the thyroid tissue, similar to Hashimoto's, which we talked about last week, and hypothyroidism after an initial stimulatory period that kind of looks like Graves. So it's like you get a little bit of both, which I think would probably be confusing diagnostically. And I did some digging on like the average time for diagnosis from like initial presenting symptom. And in the United States, it's over 6 months. When people like first start noticing signs and symptoms to the time they actually receive a diagnosis, it's over 6 months, which I thought was a little protracted compared to, I don't know, people would start feeling uncomfortable, I would think, and then turn up to their doctor. But I don't know. Yeah, it's just taking a little bit longer.
Yeah, that's not terribly surprising, just given the oftentimes many autoimmune conditions have kind of a slow smoldering kind of phase. And so they often take a little while to finally present and get diagnosed. There are some more, you know, clearly distinguishing features between Hashimoto's disease and Graves that makes it actually not terribly difficult to distinguish between them in practice. But not unusual for autoimmune conditions to linger or smolder for a while before they finally show up.
Yeah. You can also have what's known as a toxic adenoma or a multinodular goiter. So these are cells of the thyroid. They start growing independently of thyroid stimulating hormone. So effectively they're like, yeah, we don't care what you say, Dad. We're going to do our own thing. There's also a condition known as iodine-induced hyperthyroidism. This is mostly happens with underlying thyroid disease. So if they have a nodular disease already, they get a dose of iodine, their thyroid can be off to the races and effectively start pumping out a bunch of thyroid hormone. So after an iodine load, it's like contrast or drugs like amiodarone. Again, there's a lower rate of hyperthyroidism than expected in iodine deficient areas. Effectively, they just don't have the raw materials to make a bunch of thyroid hormone. Of course, you can have tumors. There are germ cell tumors like a hydatidiform mole, that's tissue from the placenta in women, or choriocarcinoma from tissue in the testes in men. Again, this is pretty rare. Same thing with the TSH producing tumors. You can get one in the pituitary gland. Usually it comes with visual deficits and other potential causes, but again, pretty rare. And the one thing I wanted to notice, just to get our podcast flagged, you know, for COVID information, there is this condition that's been discussed heavily in certain circles, known as autoimmune or inflammatory syndrome induced by adjuvants. That just means stuff that's added to vaccines, also called ASIA. It was thought that maybe you could get some hyperthyroidism due to a COVID-19 vaccination side effect. And then they did some digging here. A medical record database scan of 2.3 million people who received either an inactivated or mRNA COVID-19 vaccine failed to demonstrate a subsequent increase in the diagnosis of hyperthyroidism. So yes, you know, there's a certain base rate of like hyperthyroidism that occurs in the population. And you would expect if you run a sufficiently large sort of study on vaccine sort of side effects that there would be some people that turn up with hyperthyroidism after the vaccination. You just need to make sure that that's not higher than what normally happens in the population at age, you know, location matched sort of population. So when they did that, they said, oh, there's actually no real signal here. So I feel pretty comfortable about saying that vaccinations in general, particularly the COVID-19 vaccine, does not necessarily cause hyperthyroidism in and of itself. Austin, do you feel comfortable saying that as well?
I feel comfortable that it's probably not causing Graves' hyperthyroidism. I've not heard something like that. I think it is very plausible to me that vaccines, just like infections themselves, can cause thyroiditis. And so that is a different thing than Graves. So whereas Graves, as we said, is an autoimmune stimulation of your thyroid gland that makes the thyroid actually like, it's like making the factory grow and work over time. Thyroiditis is you blew up the factory and like everything that's inside is coming out. And so anything that causes inflammation, like an infection, or ramps up an immune response, like an immunization, can plausibly contribute to the risk of thyroiditis, which is not autoimmune in nature, but rather your thyroid gland is getting destroyed or injured in some way, and it's releasing the thyroid hormone that was already made, but it's not working in overdrive. And so thyroiditis is something that usually is self-resolving in many situations, sometimes back to normal, although sometimes people end up hypo afterwards.
Yep. And there are also drugs that can cause hyperthyroidism. So things like lithium, amiodarone, there's some other more esoteric drugs. But yeah, as always, some potential risk with certain medications. As far as labs go, as we mentioned last week, thyroid labs can be useful, though, again, signs and symptoms may vary and may not correlate to the degree of laboratory abnormality that was kind of ascertained. So first, as always, we start with the TSH, the thyroid stimulating hormone. In people with hyperthyroidism, TSH is generally low, below 0.05, and then you get a second lab draw and go from there. Now, in that second lab draw, you usually get a TSH, a free T4, and in this case, which is different than hypothyroidism, you get a T3 level as well and go from there. Also, just to reiterate, we talked about this a little bit last week, that the biotin supplement that some people take, particularly women, there could be some interference with the sort of tests for TSH. So you should basically stop that a couple of days prior to getting your thyroid labs drawn. It generally shows up as a falsely low TSH level. So you can imagine somebody's just taking biotin, like, hey, I want better skin or nails or whatever. And their TSH level is like, you know, through the floor. And like, oh, do I have hyperthyroidism? So yeah, you should basically hold that. Can mimic Graves' disease. And again, this is not an endorsement for biotin, just as a general rule. I'm not saying that it works or doesn't. My feeling on the data is that it generally doesn't do much. But yeah, if you do take it or somebody close to you does take it, yeah, would generally recommend against taking it a few days before getting your thyroid labs drawn. Okay. So in hyperthyroidism, if it's overt, in general, you have the low TSH and then your T4 and T3 levels are generally elevated. From there, there are some more digging to be done. So there's a test called the radioiodine uptake. This is useful for determining the cause of the hyperthyroidism. So if it's high, that means the thyroid gland is functional and the individual is likely making the hormone inside the thyroid itself. That basically means, hey, the thyroid gland itself is taking up iodine, appears to be functional, so on and so on. If it's low, now the thyroid gland's function is also likely low. So either it's inappropriately releasing thyroid hormone, like the thyroiditis that Austin talked about earlier, a person is taking a bunch of exogenous thyroid hormone, or there's some other autonomous source in the body that's creating thyroid hormone. So there's a bunch of different options here as well, but basically that radioiodine uptake is useful for figuring out why is this person hyperthyroid. From there, there's another test that's called the thyrotropin receptor antibody test. Thyrotropin in this case is TSH, so it's the TSH receptor antibody test. And Graves' disease is caused by an autoantibody to this receptor. So basically, once you're this far down the rabbit hole, you're like, oh, does this person have Graves or not? And so they check out to see if you have this antibody floating around in high concentrations.
Cool kids just call that the TRAB. That's what we say.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I remember that. I remember the first time I ever saw it. I go, what in the world?
Get the TRABs.
Yeah. I was like, I don't want TRABs. Turns out different than what I originally had read that as. And this is just a reminder. We talked about this last week. Exercise typically does not actually alter TSH or thyroid hormones. So like if you were worried about, should I exercise before I get my thyroid panel done? Or is it possible that exercise itself, particularly longstanding exercise, is affecting my levels? In general, not a lot. T3 and T4, like I said, tend to go up during exercise. It's useful for liberating energy for use by the active muscle tissue, but the turnover also increases. So you're basically consuming more of these thyroid hormones as well. So TSH may go up for a few hours afterwards. But overall, this is not a huge deal. 0 out of 10, would not recommend thinking about any further. My view is that exercise generally does not alter TSH, T3, or T4 levels long term. And as we always say when we talk about different medical conditions on this podcast, who should be screened for hyperthyroidism? And in general, nobody's recommending that asymptomatic individuals just get a TSH just for funsies. Effectively, you're screening those who are at risk based on either a family history or a personal history of something or symptoms or signs. So in this case, someone's got like atrial fibrillation that's otherwise unexplained or some other condition. Austin, when you're doing your primary care thing, you see some people for that.
Yeah.
How often are you just sending out a TSH?
Just sending it out? Never.
Yeah. I mean, not on its own, obviously, but, you know, effectively.
No. Yeah. Like, somebody... just doing it for the sake of it. No. Or if somebody's like, I just want to get my labs. No, I'm usually looking for reasons or if they have particular concerns. And so, you know, I'm not stingy with checking TSHs. If you look at most people's medical charts who have contact with the medical system, oftentimes they have a dozen TSHs checked in the last like 2 years, which is way more than you need. But so I'm not really like withholding it. But if anybody gives me a symptom that could plausibly be suggestive or connected, I have no problem checking it. It's, you know, cheap, quick, reliable in that way. So if they're having issues with fatigue, if they're having issues with, you know, weight issues, just like take it off the table because most of the time it's going to end up being normal. And if it's abnormal, then you can discuss the implications of like, is it abnormal enough to explain what you have going on or not, which is sure. A conversation I'm comfortable having.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So treatment of hyperthyroidism can vary, not only depending on like what the specific disease process is. It's going to look far different than somebody who's got Graves' disease versus, you know, some sort of autonomous tissue, for example, or like a multinodular goiter. But we start with some medications. So two drugs are available for treating hyperthyroidism. One is propylthiouracil, and the other one is methimazole. Both slow thyroid hormone production by inhibiting a critical step in thyroid hormone synthesis. This is basically when thyroid peroxidase, it's an enzyme in the thyroid gland, converts dietary iodine to iodide, which you need to actually make T4 and T3. Methimazole is usually preferred because PTU, the propylthiouracil, can rarely cause liver injuries, pretty significant. And these medications may take several months to normalize thyroid hormone levels, so there usually has to be some sort of adjunctive treatment in the interim. And some patients experience a remission of hyperthyroidism after treatment with these drugs, but the remission is usually temporary. So some people will be like, can I just get off these medications? Which, you know, that's the discussion you're going to have with your provider. But in general, that tends to be temporary. But again, the cause is really important to the treatment here. Another treatment that you'll see quite frequently is radioactive iodine treatment. So this uses an ingestible isotope. It's radioactive. That is the preferred therapy in most patients, especially the ones with high-risk medical conditions alongside of this, who are at high risk for surgery and need definitive management. So effectively, this is like the option to use this instead of surgery. Should be avoided in patients who are planning on becoming pregnant in the next 6 months due to the risk of inducing hypothyroidism in the fetus. Also contraindicated for lactating women. Now, this is taken orally and it enters the thyroid cells from the bloodstream and gradually destroys them. It's not possible to eliminate a precise amount. So it's not like, oh, we're going to give you this specific dose to take out 20% of your thyroid or really detect the, you know, direct where it goes. So the goal here is actually to kind of get rid of more thyroid tissue then actually needs to be gotten rid of. And then you give the person some thyroid hormone to kind of make up for the excess that was destroyed. So that is the second sort of treatment option. The third is surgery. So in rare circumstances, operating to remove most of the thyroid gland is recommended. So surgery may be the best option for a pregnant woman with severe uncontrolled disease in whom, you know, doing the radioactive isotope would not be safe for her, the baby, or people with like large compressive goiters where surgery would be beneficial, or if they have coexisting hyperparathyroidism. Those are glands that sit on the thyroid. And so if you have both, it's like, well, we're going to have to remove those surgically too, so let's just get the whole thing. Now, surgery usually leads to hypothyroidism, which is treated by lifelong thyroid hormone replacement therapy. But yeah, that's kind of what you would intuit here. After you remove the thyroid gland, you no longer have something to produce enough thyroid hormone, so you're going to have to take it. And again, like I said, most of these treatments, save for surgery, do take a little while to work. So if you have somebody with some of these adrenergic type signs and symptoms, meaning that the fight or flight system is kind of ramped up, they may need something in the interim to get them by until their thyroid hormone levels have come down to normal. So beta blockers can be used in this, like propranolol, for example, typically used only in a short-term setting to control hyperthyroid symptoms until other therapies take effect.
Yeah, I mean, it's relatively straightforward for a clinician who is trained and experienced in this, even though that sounded awful complicated. I have experience, you know, using methimazole to get patients going on their treatment. Methimazole and propranolol together, for example, do that relatively often. I've had patients undergoing radioactive iodine in the hospital, you know, setting from time to time. And then, you know, if somebody's getting surgery, sometimes they have complications or calcium issues afterwards that I sometimes need to deal with and help kind of clean up on the back end. So these are all things that are done actually relatively frequently. I suspect that there's a fair number of people listening, like in the audience, who have had Graves and have undergone various elements of this treatment or have had them discussed with them. This is not actually that esoteric of stuff.
Yeah. All right. So now we're going to transition. We're going to talk about hyperthyroidism in not only weight management, but also sport, you know, kind of see like what's going on here. So in healthy folks, active adults actually tend to have lower TSH and T4 levels. There seems to be a sort of blunted TSH response to reduced circulating T4. Now, these are all within normal ranges, just to be clear. Okay, but a similar thing actually happens with testosterone in highly active individuals, for example. And so, you know, somebody might show up to their doctor, request these labs or get these labs drawn, you know, maybe just the doctor thought, we'll just draw it anyway. And it comes back, it's low normal, or, you know, you're like, wow, why am I not directly in the median range of this sort of lab value? And yeah, it seems to actually go down a little bit. TSH and T4 levels seem to go down a little bit with people who are very, very active. This is actually part of this hypothesis where increased levels of daily physical activity suppress the metabolic activity of other physiological systems. It's part of this theory. I'm not saying that it is supportive of that theory, but this particular paper that this came from, that was their sort of hypothesis. It's like, look, if you're expending a ton of energy on physical activity, then maybe some of these other systems they don't have a lot of energy left over. And so you get slightly decreased sort of activity of those physiological systems. Again, you see it in testosterone, but again, doesn't generally cause symptoms. You see it in the thyroid, doesn't generally cause symptoms, but it might be a slight a tweak to whatever your normal lab values are. But again, if these levels are within the normal range, I'm generally not concerned. Austin, does that corroborate your sort of interpretation here?
Particularly if the person has no symptoms, right? So there are situations where the value, you know, may be expectedly in the normal range, or it may be in the normal range when it shouldn't be in the normal range. So there's a lot more thinking that has to be done. But that's an interesting observation, and maybe, you know, maybe I guess a slice or in part of a contributing mechanism to the constrained energy kind of theory, which was hot in the past couple of years. So
yeah, for sure. Now we're still talking about weight management here. And one of the common symptoms of hyperthyroidism is weight loss despite increased appetite. Now, hyperthyroidism usually causes an increase in energy use and oxygen consumption, which leads to increased catabolism and consequently weight loss in about 90% of patients, with an expected weight reduction of about 5 to 7 kilograms within the year before their presentation. So if you're, you know, losing weight without really trying, I suspect that some people would immediately be like stoked on that. But in general, as a, you know, physician or somebody with medical training, I'm kind of like, weight loss without trying, unexpected weight loss, particularly in some populations, is a sign that I'd probably want to work up. Austin, yes. How do you feel about that?
There's a lot of potentially real bad things that can cause that. So for sure, agree.
Yeah. In hyperthyroidism, the main driver of this weight loss is an increase in resting energy expenditure. However, appetite and thereby energy intake may also increase. So the increase in resting energy expenditure is about 45% in hyperthyroid individuals compared to age and weight matched euthyroid, so that's normal thyroid function controls. So in this study of relatively small women, the people with hyperthyroidism were their resting energy expenditure, so just to keep the lights on in their body, was 1,960 calories per day, whereas the euthyroid participants, their resting energy expenditure was 1,338 calories per day. So pretty significant difference there. Looks like they were using more fat for fueling, where no difference in carbohydrate use. As far as how this happens, it seems to be due to a number of different factors. So we know that thyroid signaling hormone, so TSH, from the pituitary gland, and TRH from the hypothalamus are very important when it comes to metabolism. And that's in addition to T3 and T4 themselves. At the level of the hypothalamus, that's where most of our appetite, satiety sort of centers are that contribute to food-related behaviors. There's a difference between the local levels in the hypothalamus compared to serum levels of thyroid hormone during certain conditions. So, for example, when people are fasting, in general, T3 level goes down in the serum, in the blood, right? So if somebody was fasting for an extended period of time, you took a blood draw, their T3 levels are generally going to be lower. But if you were able to assay the T3 levels in the hypothalamus themselves, they're elevated. Presumably, it's thought now to drive calorie intake, food intake. And in fact, when you give animals T3 directly into their hypothalamus, it drives food intake. And the rat models in particular become, they have hyperphagia. So they're very, very hungry. They eat a bunch. Now, interestingly, at the level of the muscle, there's a few different things that thyroid hormone can do. So in utero, thyroid hormone, it increases the conversion of slow twitch to fast twitch muscle fibers. So you wouldn't want to be deficient then. In adults, hyperthyroid tends to result in an increased glucose uptake into the muscle and increased blood flow to the muscle. Also at the level of the muscle, you get increased metabolism or oxidation or burning of leucine. You guys may remember that as a branched chain amino acid that's involved in skeletal muscle protein synthesis signaling. And you also get an increase in protein breakdown that's also increased. So overall, you get more protein catabolism that goes up by over 10%, more protein oxidation, so protein being used as fuel, that goes up by about 24%. And in addition to that, you also get increase in bone breakdown and remodeling. So you can actually get osteoporosis in hyperthyroid individuals. But there's an interesting study. They gave young dudes with normal thyroid function 100 of T3 per day for 2 weeks. And just to see like what happened to their muscle mass, to their body composition. There's actually no change in body fat, but they lost 2 kilos of muscle within 2 weeks. Which I thought was pretty interesting.
That's interesting, a little surprising, unfortunate for our bodybuilder in the original case. I guess it's also a little interesting because a lot of this is stuff that some of this stuff relating to metabolism at the hypothalamus is stuff that is also new to me. But you mentioned that folks with hyperthyroidism, their resting energy expenditure was much higher and they tended to use more lipids. And so that's also a bit surprising in this particular study. If they didn't really see much of a change in body fat, you might wonder if that's just, you know, one study found this. If you did more studies, if you might see some variation there. But the protein and muscle loss is something that bodybuilder might have liked to know about if he was going to use this. Maybe he did, and he was using all the other anabolics to mitigate it. Who knows what his mechanistic cocktail was for.
There's a few observational study or case control studies where they look at people with hyperthyroidism to like age and generally weight matched controls just to look at like, hey, do they have more lean body mass, less fat mass on average? And they don't. They have less muscle mass on average, but a similar amount of body fat. It's thought that just this elevation in protein catabolism and potentially leucine metabolism actually seems to like impair muscle protein synthesis and increase muscle protein breakdown. And so, yeah, if anything, it probably costs a little bit of muscle mass, but could be offset via polypharmacy in the case of our case study here. So when you treat hyperthyroidism, the folks' resting energy expenditure decreases. So effectively, there's less of those futile cycles where you're just creating heat but not really making any ATP. Body weight tends to increase with treatment, though weight loss prior to presentation does not necessarily correlate to the degree of hyperthyroidism. Interestingly, when assessed directly, now there's not a whole bunch of studies on this, but the weight gain after people were treated was mostly lean mass in like a 3-to-1 ratio. But of course, this can vary amongst individuals, likely due to environmental sort of inputs. So were they exercising? What was their protein intake? And so on. But overall, resting energy expenditure tends to go up quite a bit due to hyperthyroidism causing these futile cycles, decreased movement economy, so it costs you more to do similar tasks, and so on. But, so this isn't really a like get shredded quick plan to just like take a bunch of thyroid. Appetite also goes up, likely due to some of these processes directly, but also probably a compensatory response to lost weight. Like if you're just losing weight and your appetite goes up, some sort of compensatory mechanism, and then maybe some direct sort of signaling from elevated thyroid levels at the level of the hypothalamus. That's kind of as far as I got.
Pretty cool. Honestly, the stuff in the hypothalamus was new to me. Nice find.
Yeah, there's a whole nother rabbit hole, like different isoforms of like various thyroid metabolites that you know. Now, granted, most of that stuff's in animal models, so it's, you know, tough to really say, yeah, this is what happens in humans too, but interesting nonetheless.
It's reflective of how many, I mean, we've talked before plenty about all the different biological variables that kind of coalesce to generate our ultimate kind of appetite and food drive, so to speak. And so this is just one among many of them that are, again, these people are not choosing to have elevated T3 in their hypothalamus outside your conscious control.
That's the thing, right? So yeah, normally when humans fast, their T3 levels go down. That's been pretty well established, but like actual sampling at the level of the hypothalamus shows a higher level of T3 hormone and like maybe some increased sensitivity to it based on like receptor sort of modulation, which I thought was interesting. It kind of reminds me of leptin in a way. Like we thought that leptin being associated with like body fat, that it should just be kind of like a thermostat in a way, right? If your body fat level got high enough, yeah, you'd have a high level of leptin. That's a satiating hormone, at least we thought it was, and it would like pump the brakes on your appetite. It turns out it doesn't really do that at all. In fact, it's most active when body fat levels are way low and leptin levels are low, and the body's like, oh crap, we don't have any leptin. That means we must not have any body fat, must not have any energy stores, and people become ravenous.
Yeah, way. I just that think of it as the function. I think of leptin as the hangry hormone when you're very, very lean. Not hangry in general, because most people who get hangry are not very, very lean, but in that particular context, it would make you hangry.
Yeah, I like that hangry hormone. All right, I feel a new article brewing. All right, so let's pivot here and talk about hyperthyroidism and exercise. Now, both hypo and hyperthyroidism, they both have exercise intolerance. Now, in hypothyroidism, that's what we discussed last week, these people have a large VO2 max reduction in both animal and human models. But again, it's admittedly limited on human models. Nobody's taking somebody's hypothyroid and saying, hey, before we treat you, can we do a graded exercise test just real quick to see what your VO2 max is? So yeah, limited data there for sure. Seems to be due to decreased cardiac output. You get a lower heart rate and less stroke volume. So the heart's not pumping as much blood out into the periphery. So you get less blood flow to the active muscles. So you're getting less delivery of oxygen and energy to the muscles. Now the muscles themselves, they're still able to contract with the same normal amount of force, although these are from animal studies, but they are more fatigable due to reduced muscle oxidative capacity, its ability to use oxygen, and again, reduced blood flow. The high force anaerobic fibers are generally fine because they don't typically rely on that, but they're only around for a short period of time because before they also become fatigued. You also get a slower contraction in the velocity of the muscle. So the muscle's actually ability to contract quickly goes down. And this is due to a different myosin ATPase. This is just an enzyme used to create ATP at the level of the muscle. And there are two major isoforms. One's fast and one is slow. Well, the slow one predominates in hypothyroid. So if you really wanted to differentiate between hypo and hyperthyroid, you could think of hypo as like Eeyore kind of going around.
Sure.
Hey, man, you're just a little like tuned down. And then hyperthyroidism is the exact opposite. You're tuned up. Yeah. Muscle glycogen use in hypothyroidism is unchanged or potentially increased. Lactate levels when people exercise with hypothyroidism are generally similar, perhaps a little greater, but they're not able to use as much free fatty acids because they don't have enough thyroid hormone on board. Now, in hyperthyroidism, that's what we're discussing today, you get a slight reduction in VO2 max, but not as much as you see in hypothyroidism. But the slight reduction in VO2 max is due to a higher resting heart rate. You get higher blood flow to the muscles, including the heart muscle, and you get increased oxygen delivery, and you get a lower vascular resistance. So the blood vessels in the periphery are dilated, and it also happens at the level of muscle. And you get that fast form of the myosin ATPase, so you can make energy quickly. All this seems awesome. Seems like a performance-enhancing drug, but the muscles are way more efficient at using muscle glycogen, and they use it much, much faster. They get a higher lactate level when tested in humans, about 24% higher. And this was interesting. The difference in oxygen between the artery side and the venous side of the tissue is actually reduced. So less oxygen is being offloaded in these tissues. So it seems like, yeah, we're pumping a ton of blood to the muscles. Cool. Got to have a lot of oxygen, a lot of energy being delivered. But it's just not hopping off of the red blood cell.
That this can sometimes be seen in kind of like hyperdynamic states. In other words, situations where that cardiac output is really high, the blood vessels are dilated, stuff, you know, the blood is flying past the tissues faster than it can really feasibly extract the oxygen at that level. So that's one potential way that I could envision this happening if you are in that degree of like thyrotoxic kind of state. This wouldn't be like in just like a mild hyperthyroidism so much as a much more significant clinical hyperthyroidism situation.
Yeah. So, and because the muscles you're using glycogen so quickly, there's a higher risk of hypoglycemia that actually people with hyperthyroidism actually have. Also, reduced exercise performance is probably due, at least on some level, to this relative hyperthermia. They have problems dissipating heat, probably because they're creating a bunch of heat through those futile cycles, and they have a higher metabolic rate at the same workload. So actually, when you treat these patients, they become more efficient at movement, and that's one of the sources of decreased energy expenditure. So overall, hyper and hypothyroidism have different sort of mechanisms of why exercise capacity is reduced, but they both present with reduced sort of exercise tolerance, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, it is. And also, again, makes, you know, screwing with your thyroid status stupid if you're, you know, planning on bodybuilding, et cetera.
Yeah, 0 out of 10, would not recommend. Okay, so maybe a little time for a little tepid take. The tepid take portion of the Barbell Medicine podcast here, episode 305 with Dr. Austin Baraki. So is hyperthyroid treatment, particularly in the acute phase when you're sort of, hey, look, we've got some methimazole on board. Most people are going to require some beta blockers, at least for a little bit, to get them through. And beta blockers have been on the prohibited list for WADA for a number of years. These group of medications inhibit beta adrenergic receptors. Again, these receptors that respond to adrenaline and similar sort of substances, thereby reducing heart rate, potentially anxiety, and so on, although they are not a great treatment for anxiety in general, just as an aside. This could potentially enhance performance in sports where precision and accuracy are vital. Now, there's one study that was commissioned. It was a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled crossover study where they gave amateur marksmen beta blockers. And this study showed that, on average, participants improved their shooting when taking metoprolol, which is a beta blocker, compared with placebo. And it seemed to be a bigger benefit in the more skilled individuals, more skilled marksmen. Therefore, it seems that beta blockers do improve shooting performance and possibly other precision and accuracy sports that were also included in WADA's sort of list here, which includes archery. There's actually a case of a New Zealand archer who tested positive for a beta blocker and got his results sort of wiped earlier this year. Auto racing, billiards, darts, golf. Mini golf, that's a recent addition. I did not know that that was an IOC-recognized sport, but it sure is. Some skiing and snowboarding type sports, related sports. Also free diving, spear phishing, and target shooting. I don't know if free diving I'd want my heart rate to go way down, but I guess I could make a case if it slows down your breathing, maybe that's beneficial for you being able to dive. Austin, what do you think about this? Should this be on the prohibited list? Like, what's the deal?
I mean, I think that this is very much a situation where the potential of it as a PED, as with most PEDs, is dependent on the demands of the sport. And so you notice that in most of these sports that you outlined, there is not a The sport is not limited by your cardiorespiratory capacity. We'll put it that way, right? Whereas in sports where it is, for example, say in endurance running or swimming or even sprinting, I imagine to some degree as well, I would expect to see more of a compromise in performance. And so whether it's performance enhancing or compromising really depends on the task demands. In the same way that, you know, I don't know that I would expect EPO use to help you at darts necessarily, whereas it can make you, you know, way fitter and more able to compete on the level of the Tour de France or similar, if you can even survive that race. And so, yes, I do see beta blockers as something that, to the extent we are going to regulate substance use in sport and make things banned or not, then there are sports where I would expect it to have a performance enhancing effect. And so under that paradigm, yeah, it makes sense that it would be.
Yeah, I guess I'm inclined to agree. I just try to pull up that Russian curler who was stripped of his Olympic medal. I think it was like one of the Winter Olympics, because I think he was using like anabolic steroids to be a curler. And I was like, I wouldn't think that that'd be performance enhancing, but I don't know what sort of training volume that they're working with. I generally agree that beta blockers are probably likely to improve performance, although this single study is not, you know, super awesome in my estimation. I just wonder with like golf or like, you know, mini golf. Now that I know golf, professional golf in particular, you can't drink while you're on the course. That's like, you can be disqualified if you, you know, were caught using alcohol. And so is that a PED in this particular case? Or is it more of a professionalism thing? I don't know. I went through the list. There's a published list of everybody who's currently on the sanction list. And I just searched LOL. There were no beta blockers that I could find on the list. The only LOL ending drug was stenozolol, Winstrol. Yeah. And believe me, there were a ton of those. Yeah. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I guess here's the thing. If you got to have a prohibited like list, it needs to be something that people are using regularly, I think. Right. Now, whether or not it's because just these sports have a lower sort of population pool to draw from, you know, and maybe these are the only sports where there could potentially be an improvement and everybody else is like, ah, beta blockers not going to improve performance in powerlifting, for example, or like Olympic weightlifting. OK, I'm willing to buy that and just, you know, shut up about it. But like if nobody's really using this, like do you need to have like a policy against it? I don't know, man. Like, for example, you need a policy against PCP. Like just, you know, I don't know that people are using that and then performing a high level of sport. You've kind of weeded yourself out, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that could be considered potentially a PED in like MMA, and that's kind of about it.
Yeah.
Theoretically, even though that is probably more of a myth than a reality in terms of the agitation and aggression you get from it. But yeah, I mean, I see your point to some extent. I mean, all of this just needs to be couched in the broader context of like, you know, is this whole thing even effective, or is it more of a charade, or, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I'm kind of the opinion that our current drug testing protocols are probably not evidence-based, are ineffective at like, you know, dissuading people from using. And then further, the penalties are not like big enough to prevent people from using given the rates of positive tests. Yeah, we talked about that with Robert Pelkey Jr. on a previous podcast. All right, let's wrap this up, Rocky. Episode 305, talking about hyperthyroid. Hyperthyroidism means that there's too much thyroid hormone in the body, which generally occurs from the thyroid making or releasing too much, some other tissue source making too much, or people taking too much thyroid. Now, there are many different causes of hyperthyroidism, and it can show up in different ways. The most common cause of hyperthyroidism, particularly in young women, is Graves' disease. And this is a type of autoimmune disease that stimulates the thyroid to make a bunch of thyroid hormone. Symptoms vary based on the severity and specific cause of excess thyroid hormone, but commonly people with hyperthyroidism experience anxiety, emotional lability, weakness, tremors, palpitations in their heart, heat intolerance, increased sweating, and weight loss despite a normal or increased appetite. They can also have cardiovascular signs like atrial fibrillation or even heart failure like our original case. Excess thyroid hormone does not appear to be beneficial for performance as it reduces exercise tolerance by making muscles fatigue faster, and it also seems to potentially increase muscle breakdown in general. The treatment for hyperthyroidism should be managed by a trained medical professional. Ideally, an individual with hyperthyroidism would be returned to a normal or euthyroid state, which typically requires medication or surgery, plus or minus future hormone replacement as needed. As always, we recommend working with a healthcare provider if you're concerned about thyroid function. We do not recommend direct-to-consumer thyroid lab testing, much less self-guided treatment. Thyroid supplementation in high doses above the normal range carries significant health risks with unclear benefit on performance, and you might potentially wind up in the hospital. That'd be a bad way to meet Dr. Baraki.
Yeah, would not like to meet you in cardiogenic shock on event. So yeah, overdosing on T3, bad idea.
0 out of 10, would not recommend. Anything to add?
No, I think we crushed it.
All right. That's a wrap on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, episode 305 about hyperthyroidism. Shout out to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining me on this podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. For everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
Thank you. It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now. Save big.